Greco, Sports of 590 The Fan, Blake Murphy, Ailish Forfar, JD Bunkus. Give them a follow on their socials. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. The Fan Morning Show. Should be a fun one. Jay's last night, less fun. To help us sort through, former Blue Jays first base coach, Tim Leeper. Tim, how are you this morning, man?
I'm doing great. You guys doing good?
Doing excellent. I have a question for you about your experience as a first base coach before we get into the specifics from last night. Now, last year, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. got a bit of a reputation as running some interesting routes after fly balls, but then he had a million outfield assists. Last night, Teoscar Hernandez bobbles the ball a little bit, and it sets up an outfield assist. If you're a base coach, how worried are you that when it looks like the Jays corner outfielders are making a mistake, they might just be rope-a-doping you into taking the extra base?
That would be great. As the outfield, I was also the outfield coach, so the outfield coach in me thinks that's really good strategy, and it is really good. But it's funny, that play was that was an interesting play. It looked like he did totally rope, and then Gurriel's going against the wall and making catches. So, yeah, it you know, it's all part of their complete package. So it wouldn't worry me too much. But that was some good baseball last night for sure. That throw home was money. And I it's so funny with it being Donaldson that got thrown out. And I think he made a decision on himself. Like, the first thing I look for to see is if third base coach made a mistake, because I'm sure it wasn't going to be fun for that guy in the dugout if that happened.
I love that you looked for the third base coach immediately. Like, you're already on here stumping for the coaches. Like, and it was all Donaldson. He did that all on his own, guys. I saw it clear as day. Donaldson blew right through the sign. He should have listened to his coach. No big deal. You mentioned it, though, Tim. You were an outfield coach as well. I wonder what you make of just Teoscar's outfield defense to start this year, because it looks a little bit better.
It looks good. He kind of goes in and out, but he's really honest with, when he's cleaned up everything and the bats coming, I think he gets relaxed and he plays well in all areas of his game. Like, he's really come to peace, I think, the last 2.5 years, and it shows up in his whole game. And you know, there's no better guy. You know, he struggled with us defensively when we were there. We just got him. But there's so many other things going on. And it's just, for a guy who's such a great human being, and if you ever had the pleasure of being around him, you know how decent a guy he is, how great a guy he is. It's nice to see the piece. And I think that transitions not only to the offensive side of it, but to the defensive side as well.
So that defense last night does come through in a way that keeps that game close the whole way. And it maybe wasn't heading that way, the way Yusei Kikuchi got off to a start. So he only goes 3 1/3, gets in some trouble. Could have been worse if the defense doesn't pick him up. What was your initial impression of Kikuchi last night, and how, you know, this is a guy who in a weaker division with some more pitcher friendly parks was a bit home run prone. There's a lot of loud contact last night. What are your impressions of him and how he's going to fit in this division?
I don't take a lot of stock in the first couple of games. It's like I think the first couple of times through, you're getting a feel for it, and I it's emotional, like playing in these American League series. You know the home opener was a big one, obviously, with Berrios, and then last night, you know, playing in Yankee Stadium as a member of a team in the American League East. I think the bigger thing, and literally last night, he was lucky to get out. He could have been out of there in the first if they don't make those plays. But the one thing I think. You start to look to see what he wants to do in terms of pitch selection. You know, I think that's the one thing, you know, Pete and the Blue Jays have done really well, is when guys come over, you know, they really want to mix up the selection and the pitch usage of what they want the guys to use. And you kind of saw it last night. But, you know, what you didn't count for was the really, really big misses. And that's the thing that's going to have to tighten up as he goes along, is like, you know, he's got really electric stuff, as you can see. But when you're missing, you know, by 5 feet with your slider, you know, and you're not setting up your pitches, and then guys can start eliminating pitches and not swinging at them, that's when you're going to give up the hard contact. And I think that's what you saw last night. But I think it's still a work in progress. I mean, I think, the short spring training didn't help. He's not quite there. He's probably had Pete and them probably haven't got together as much as they're going to in the future. And also, I think Danny Jansen was probably a guy that caught him a lot in the spring, and him finding that comfort with the catcher. I mean, those are the things you need to sort out early in the season. The injury to Danny probably didn't help, but I think there's a lot of things that are moving forward that are going to make him a lot better pitcher. But I think you saw that, like, what exactly he wants to do going forward. You saw that last night.
So it's not just Kikuchi that's had, you know, not a favorable start here for Blue Jays. And, you know, it's a bit tense. You know, people are worried about the rotation, but you said give them a little bit of time. How much time before we hit the panic button? You know, how much leeway is it because of the spring training being shortened and these new guys getting a feel for the team and playing in the AL East? Like, what is an expectation for them to be back into their groove?
You give them 10 starts, and I think it takes a long time. It's such a marathon. It's 162 games. And really, honestly, the best teams about the midway point are they're still kind of finding themselves out. One thing with these guys, that once they hit these streaks, and you see pitchers that get on these, I mean, we saw it with Marco Estrada, we saw it with Aaron Sanchez, we saw it with Stroman, like, they hit a groove and then you just can't stop them. So it's a long way down the road. Once everybody getting their feet underneath them, it is a short spring training. I'm sure with JD, every time I call, it's like Barrios had a bad start. I have to talk you off the ledge here.
Yeah. I actually was not going to do that because I did. But yeah, okay. You know, my position on him before has been, I think I really love the pitcher. He's been consistent year over year. But I am a little worried about two things when they got Barrios. One is you come into a really competitive environment when you haven't really had that before. And I do wonder what you look like in big spots. And two is career history against the Yankees is not very good, especially at Yankee Stadium. And it's a team that he's going to have to face a lot. Now you've sort of got both of those things happening tonight, Tim, where he struggled out of the gate. He barely recorded an out in the home opener. And I don't know if you saw what I saw, but it seemed like he was nervous. And I don't love that from a guy that's supposed to be your ace. And especially considering it's like the position, the nature of the position, I want guys to go out there and be just sort of cold-blooded assassins. And now you got a game against Gerrit Cole and feels a little heavier because, yeah, it's a rubber match game in a four-game series, whatever, but it's at a place that you historically struggle, and the guy on the other side of the mound is going to be Gerrit Cole, or the guy that takes the mound after you is Gerrit Cole. So I do wonder if, like, you put a little bit of extra stock into seeing a bounce back from a guy. Not that you're changing the projections of the year, but what the value of a bounce back is even early on in the season.
Yeah, and I think that's a great – I mean, like, if you're a fan, you just set up the game perfectly. That's exactly what you want to see. There's a lot of subplots in this game. I kind of like the nervousness. It shows the respect for the organization. But, again, like, you hit the nail on the head. Like, he hasn't pitched in a lot of these situations. He hasn't pitched without a line. I think this is where you continue to see guys grow, and this is going to be really fun to watch this happen because this stuff's good enough. And I really, truly believe he's one of those guys that is going to hit that hot streak, and then all of a sudden he's going to go out 10 starts in a row, and every time you go out there, you feel like he's going to win that game. So, I mean, I think that's a great thing going forward. I think this is going to be good. I like the fact that he had that emotion going, and them being able to control that emotion is going to be the big key for them. But it's not all on him. They got some really good depth in their rotation. But like, if you're looking for a lot of things going on, as long as the game starts on time today for Cole, then it's going to be a good matchup.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good matchup too. And again, it's always hard. I say this all the time, but yeah, you have hard takes on pitchers who have bad outings. You're going to look like an idiot because good pitchers, they're going to end up like regressing in a positive way, and so you can't have too harsh takes. And again, I like Barrios. I just, the nervousness thing or the emotional thing, it's a fine balance, right? Because Manoah has a lot of emotion to his game, but he seems to be able to control it really, really well despite what the spot is. And I hate comparing one guy to the next with the exact when it comes to the emotional comportment or the way they handle themselves, because it gets into tricky gray areas. But yeah, Barrios, I want to see it tonight. So what do you care about early on in the season, Tim? Like, outside of health, obviously, but like, yeah, as a guy who's a coach, what do you want to see from your players early on in the year? Because it's such a long season, and like I said, it all becomes sample sizes and what do you do in a couple of months? What do you do after 10 starts? But what do you try to quantify as a coach when you're only a couple series into a season with 162 games?
You nailed it. Health is a big thing. You just need to see guys get their feet on the ground and fall into those routines. Because it's funny, because you go through the league once, and you're either really hot or you're really cold, and then the league makes an adjustment, and then it becomes normal, like, from that point on. So, again, that's probably around, 40, 50 games. And so you just want to see guys healthy. You want to see guys, be able to work through something. If you're struggling, you want to see a guy that doesn't give up, and you want to see a guy that keeps grinding and getting better, whether it's from a pitching standpoint or the hitting standpoint. And if you see a hot guy, you want to try to keep him hot. I think the cool thing with the little plot, the subplots that we're just talking about, is like so much talk has been like, this has been the greatest offseason. This is like the best team. It's gonna be easy, and it's not. And again, I love this team's confidence. I love the fact that they honestly, you can tell how much they love being around each other. But these little things that happen early in the season are really kind of the building blocks for what goes on moving forward. And when the American League East, no matter how good your team is never going to be easy. And so, like, just the small little wake up calls, realizing, like, oh my God, I got to be better. We got to be better because Yankees are always going to be good. The Red Sox are going to be good. The Rays are going to be good. It's just a really, really good division. It's always competitive. And you just want to see them get their footing underneath them. And again, this, especially with this team, just keep respecting the league for the division for what it is, because it's no guarantee that, you know, anything good is going to happen. I mean, at the end of the day, you still lost a guy who was a potential MVP, and you lost a Cy Young winner. And I think the pieces have to fall in around that to, like, this team is going to be a lot different than that team, and it's really interesting. But also, like, realize, like, it's not going to be easy. I mean, we had a really good team last year. We didn't get in. So you just kind of – I want to see them, you know, and I don't think they disrespect it at all, but just show the respect that's necessary in order to, like, win a really, really tough division.
It also puts the pressure on every little marginal decision, right? Because every win, every run could be the difference when the division projects as this tight. And where that's reared its head already and threatens to the next couple weeks here is you lose Danny Jansen to an oblique injury. Not only is he, you know, your best defensive catcher and the guy who's expected to catch Ryu and Kikuchi, who are on the tougher end of pitchers to catch, but now you're looking at, okay, well, Alejandro Kirk might have to play in the field a little bit more instead of DHing. So maybe you have his bat a little bit less because he needs more off days. You have Zach Collins and Tyler Heineman playing regularly now or semi-regularly between the two of them. How do you see them managing the catching situation this next little bit? Because, you know, there are question marks about Kirk's defense even as he's improved. And they do have a guy in AAA who doesn't have a lot of experience yet, but people seem pretty high on. How are you managing this catching situation the next couple weeks?
Well, that's tough. And I know the other guy played his first game last night, and I just saw him get a two-strike curveball off Sanchez. It looks really good. It's hard. I mean, you realize now, like, how important Danny Jansen is to this team. And like, when you're sitting there with the scenarios that you just brought up, It's a big deal. And I think, the familiarity with Danny and the pitching staff is good. I also look at this as a way for Kirk not to be looking over his shoulder and to really up his game defensively. I mean, there's a lot of things he does well. I mean, he still strikes really well. He's matured a lot. His bat's going to come into play anymore. It's going to be interesting to see what happens when the roster shrink, if they still want to continue with three catchers, because in this situation it is right now, it's almost like you have to if you want to have – Kirk as a part-time DH. So again, these are the things early in the season that I don't think are necessarily bad. I mean, I like to look at these things with a glass half empty thing, because you can be sitting there at the midway point and be in third place and be, you know, around 500, even a little bit below, and knowing that good run's coming and baseball's going. But like, these are the things that elevate guys' games too, and I think this is a really good chance. I don't think the backup catching situation is really going to change. I think you kind of know what you have in terms of Collins and in terms of whoever else is up there,
Heineman,
with Heineman. But
we don't know either.
I do now. He was with us a couple of years ago, so I just drew a blank there. But I think it is a good time for guys to step up their game. And when you go into a season and you're trying to win, you need all 25, 26 guys in your rosters to contribute. And these are the kinds of situations that create themselves that can really, really help your team get better in the future.
Tim, thanks as always for making time. Thanks as always for offering an actual baseball guy's perspective rather than, you know, someone who's already looking at takes early in the year. This is always fun, buddy. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for guys having me. I appreciate it.
Take care. Tim Leeper, former Blue Jays first base coach, and fan favorite around these parts. And I actually like that he put the Berríos nervousness in terms of the respect for the franchise, but I go, yeah, respect them in other ways. You know, respect them in ways that don't involve getting chased after less than an inning. And tonight, I do. I do want to see what the bounce back looks like. And I believe in bounce backs, right? I think that really shows resilience, and that shows you a lot of who you are. It's easier to bounce back if it's a nothing game against the Mariners in the middle of the year. It's just something when you're pitching against Gerrit Cole. One of the games that I'm referring to when I think back about Berríos in big spots is the game where they played the Angels, and it was he was facing the MVP, or he was head-to-head with the MVP, or however you want to put it. But Shohei Ohtani was on the mound, and so was Berríos, and Berríos didn't pitch very well. If you guys remember last year, he had the game where he pulled himself out of it because he didn't really have it. Tonight, Gerrit Cole, Yankees, yep, it's April. I want 10 starts. He's going to end up having a terrific season for the Blue Jays overall. But, yeah, I like little tests throughout the year, and these little markers matter to me. And so I want to see Berríos go out and deal. I want to see him go 6 strong, maybe even 7, get that pitch count closer to, you know, the 90s, and deliver for the Blue Jays. That's what big money pitchers are expected to do. It's not – the games matter just as much as April as they do later in the year.
They do. So in terms of rotation concern, it brings us pretty naturally to Something to Chew On, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
When we talk about small samples, I want to put a little context here, and it's something you can chew on and something you can keep in mind the next couple weeks. It's obviously very early. It's why we do the It's Early But segment early on. It's why we qualify the questions we're asking Tim Leeper with, hey, it's just one time through the order. The first thing is we have 4 hours of a show. You know, we got to talk about these things. It's what's happening in the game and what people are curious about. But if you're curious as to when it's no longer early, when it's no longer a small sample size, to give you some context, they've like the people at FanGraphs and Beyond the Box Score and places like that have done what's called a stabilization rate study. So at what point is your stat for this year pretty predictive of your stat the rest of the way? So, hey, if you're striking out 25% of the time, does that mean much? Or, you know, at what point do we project that forward? So even the earliest stabilization stats require 50 to 100 plate appearances. So if you're looking at, oh, Matt Chapman has a 42% strikeout rate over 19 plate appearances, well, swing percentage doesn't stabilize until 50 plate appearances, strikeout percentage at 60 plate appearances, contact percentage at 100 plate appearances. If you're looking at something that's changed in Kikuchi's profile or Ryu's profile or Berríos' profile, we're talking about 17 innings for strikeout percentage. We're talking about 25 innings for ground ball, fly ball, splits. So we're a ways away. George Springer leads this team with 24 plate appearances. Alek Manoah is the only starter that's gone longer than 5 innings. We got lots of time here. I'm only highlighting this here, A, because I was originally going to do a Gabriel Moreno thing as the somebody to chew on, and we covered him off in the first block, but also because I do get some questions sometimes about, okay, when is it not a small sample anymore? When is it telling us something? When do we need to start changing our priors and our expectations for a guy with new data? So a little bit away still, even for the earliest stabilizing stats. So keep that in mind. Try to be patient with your Matt Chapmans and your Yusei Kikuchis, etc.
What is the conversion rate from, you know, 100 plate appearances to days?
So 50 plate appearances, you know, George Springer has 24 so far. So you're looking at, for a guy at the top of the order, maybe 11 games.
Okay.
Yeah. Into the season. So, but that's for the earliest stabilizing things. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about, you know, Santiago Espinal's new power, we're looking at a longer sample there. We might need 20 games mm-hmm. to be like, okay, this is a real change in his profile, which is why yesterday, and I have a quick video coming up on Espinal today, and part of that is, you know, hey, he showed this for 20 games at the end of last year too, and in spring training. So you look for opportunities to expand the sample like that.
So the reason why we do It's Early But is not to remind the audience that it's early, Blake. It's to be funny. Like, you're
I know. I'm not trying to kill
but you went through, like, 25 things where you're like, and we would like to also explain that
nothing
we have a
we
job to do.
Important.
Like, no. This is the point. Is I actually hate pandering to the audience with early baseball takes in terms of this, where you go, hey, if you can't figure out that it's early on your own when it's the first couple of weeks of April, then that says something about you as a fan, and that's fine if you're brand new to this sport, but my job is not to tell you that it's early in a baseball season that has 162 games and the Blue Jays have played a few, and that what we do here is come on and give radio takes and talk about baseball, talk about the baseball team. So yes, it's early, but are people still not getting things? As a usual perpetual take. So I do. Like I said, tonight, Berríos and Gabriel Moreno, don't think that's too early. But yes, absolutely. I actually thought that, you know, 50 plate appearances sounds very small. So that's kind of interesting that it actually does have some bearing that you're using numbers from that point forward, or that you actually would use numbers like that moving forward. Because what was the old standard test? It was like 250 plate appearances was when baseball people would usually start to say the sample mattered.
Yeah, it depends on the stat in general. But like OBP, you're looking at about 110 games. Slugging, you're looking at about 100 games. You know, even exit velocity, you're looking at 15 to 20 games before that starts to stabilize a little bit and we can draw any sort of conclusion from it.
I got to tell you, I would say that out of all the chews, I'm so glad that we did touch on Gabriel Moreno, because that is fascinating to me. It's like stabilization rates is good. That's a really good little piece of information. That is something to chew on. And also, I'm going to memorize it because I won't ever fully understand it like Blake. So I just have to memorize it, you know, so that I can do the test. So that whenever I give a hot take on something after 50 plate appearances, I can go, well actually,
said.
The stabilization rate, and then crack my knuckles and get ready to tell people what I just memorized. Really good something to chew on. Really good basketball games last night. The first one didn't look like it was going to be good, but does it matter that Kevin Durant and Kyrie got outplayed by a pretty below mediocre Cavs team for three quarters? Or does it matter more that KD and Kyrie missed like no shots?
Yeah, well, you want to talk about stabilization rates? Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving refusing to miss, pretty stable after one game, after 50 games, after 100 games. There is no stabilization rate or small sample size at this point when it comes to, KD and Kyrie, when the game called for it, early in the first quarter as they pulled away, and then late in the third as Cleveland tried the Raptors' memorial fake comeback. Yeah, yep. KD and Kyrie are going to take you a long way when they're locked in.
Okay, so should the Nets be favored in a series against the Celtics? That's next on the Fan Morning Show. JD, Blake, and Ailish. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590, The Fan. JD Bunkus, Ailish Forfar, Blake Murphy, who again has a video today coming out on Santiago Espinal, everybody's favorite Blue Jay, the hottest man on the planet. Not even he could save the Blue Jays yesterday, though. Tough one at the dish. Hate games like that where you just feel like you're watching a team. Like you know you have confidence in the team, but you have no confidence in the game, if that makes sense, where you just go, they don't have it tonight. They're just not being able to figure it out tonight, especially against the Nestor Cortez. Those are the worst ones where it's just, why aren't they beating the brakes off this guy? Why aren't they just putting a bunch of balls into the yard? Why is it that, they're still in it, Vladdy's up, there's two runners on, and then bang, you know, just, the game's over, the night's over, you just watched 3 hours of tough baseball. At least you had good basketball games last night, though, right? It was kind of a sleepy performance by the Leafs, we touched on it, Keith hammered his team over it, and the Blue Jays, that's not a game you're going to remember this year, unless it's the Kikuchi debut, but the Bats, it's a forgettable one, but you're moving on to tonight with Jose Berríos. Kevin Durant, you know, by the way, quick betting thing. I saw this on SN Bets' account. Do you know that 92% of bets were on Kevin Durant to hit the over yesterday?
We talked about that in the show. Maybe that's why the listeners...
92%. That is... Kevin Durant's so petty, and you know he hates basketball fans so much that I'm starting to be like, I hope no one floated that to KD. Like, hey, KD, people need 30 points from you tonight. He's like,
how about 29?
Assists. Yeah, exactly. Looks like an assist night for KD. He didn't take a three until, I think, the fourth quarter. So, suspect either way. Durant plays extremely well. I thought it was a brilliant game from him in terms of trying to get his teammates involved and making sure that he didn't put too big a workload on his shoulders right out of the gate. Kyrie looked brilliant. Blake, did seeing them play the Cavs that way embolden the way that you feel about the Nets? Because teams were avoiding them, right? Teams were saying, give us the Raptors over the Nets, give us anybody over the Nets. Everybody strategized to avoid Brooklyn. Did you feel like they made a good decision doing that after watching them play yesterday, or were you a little bit more in a little bit closer to where we thought we might be, which is, hey, this team, for as good as those two guys are, it did require an unbelievable first quarter and an unbelievable shooting night for them to just kind of squeak by a bad team.
Here's the thing, though. Those unbelievable quarters and unbelievable shooting nights are par for the course for this team, right? Like, they only shot 32% as a team on threes. Yeah. They'll be like, Seth Curry's not going to go 0-for all that long. The people around Brooklyn seem to think they're going to get Ben Simmons in this Boston series, and then suddenly you're not playing our guy Big Kess, who tried his hardest.
No,
KD,
don't bring it up.
Tried his hardest to make the game closer so that KD had to score more. I think that what you saw last night is a Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving who are pretty comfortable playing together. So I took a look at the stats yesterday, and if you filter out minutes they played with James Harden, since he's not there anymore, when KD and Kyrie shared the floor together without Harden, they had an offensive rating of about 125. So 1.25 points every time down the floor. That is ridiculous. And even against a defense as good as Boston's, they were the best defense in basketball, especially in the second half of the season. They were the best defense in basketball against the top teams in the NBA. This is going to be a really, really difficult matchup with Durant and Irving. And you know, I can't imagine this game script in a Boston series is going to call for 19 Bruce Brown field goal attempts.
Nope.
You're going to see a little bit more Seth Curry. You're probably going to see a lot more Patty Mills to space the floor and kind of, you know, dare, hey, if Marcus Smart is the guy trying to chase after you and play out the Patty Mills side of that matchup, then you're fine with that. My concern level with Brooklyn, honestly, going ahead to that Boston series, is I don't know what Andre Drummond's place in a series against the Celtics is. And if Ben Simmons isn't back, or Ben Simmons comes back and comes off the bench or is capped for minutes or whatever, I don't really know what you do at that position for Brooklyn to make sure. I mean, I know Robert Williams isn't there, but the Celtics are not going to respect Drummond, and I don't know that he's going to make a huge difference to that series. So that was a rambly way of saying Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving are Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, and that is going to keep you in just about any basketball series you could play in. If they get Simmons back, especially defensively, because this isn't a very good defensive team, defensively, that could be huge. That could be huge in terms of KD and Kyrie both getting to work off the ball instead of kind of taking turns as point guards. I would still fear Brooklyn if I'm the Boston Celtics. Like, if I'm a Celtics fan, this is worst case scenario nightmare for a very good regular season.
Yes, that was a nightmare game. I mentioned to you last night in text that it should be noted that Cleveland outscored Brooklyn in three of the four quarters, but that was also me trying to find a stretcher and trying to find a narrative, because game script does matter. And you could tell that that was the case, especially in the fourth quarter. There was never really a moment in that game where Kevin Durant or Kyrie struggled, right? They had stretches
Bruce
where
Bruce Brown took 19 shots and almost had a triple-double. Just never going to ask him to do that in a tighter spot.
Exactly. And I'm always someone who, and I guess this is kind of an advice, little piece of advice for people who are or sports betting, but one of the things that I do oftentimes when I'm live betting a basketball game is I go, who's getting easier offense? Like, if a team is down, are they getting easy offense and clean looks, or are they just fighting it and they're hitting ridiculous shots that are unsustainable? And that's a real, you can eye test that out. Last night, Kyrie and KD got to anywhere they wanted on the floor. KD didn't have to do, he didn't shoot any threes, Blake. He just went, okay, I'm going to take out the most valuable thing from my arsenal, and we're still going to beat the Cleveland Cavaliers. There were multiple opportunities where KD had the, I'm bringing the ball up the floor, I could totally pull for a three-pointer, which I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm guessing it's probably around a 34-33% shot, his pull-up three. Maybe it's even better than that over the course of his career. He overlooked that multiple times to make sure that the ball moved around the team, that guys were getting touches, that Kyrie felt involved, and that Kyrie was basically just going to be running this team's offense for the first game and getting as many cookies as possible. I really just thought it was Yeah, an extremely, extremely beautiful game from KD, and a reminder sort of to the rest of the league that, like, hey, if the two of us are healthy, we're going to score. So you better not have off-shooting nights. You better not have games where you dry up from the floor. And if we're playing the Boston Celtics, you know, Jason Tatum, you're having a really nice year. But what happens if we can just let Jason Tatum score? Like, who's going to be the other guy that hangs around with Kyrie and KD? Because Brown hasn't really proven that. And Marcus Smart has had a terrific year. But if you're a Nets fan, you're probably feeling pretty comfortable about games where Marcus Smart is firing, you know, 6+ 3-point shots, especially ones off the dribble and off of high screens. I think it's appropriate that the Celtics, a team that we're very high on, are underdogs going into this series.
So a couple, just to round out a couple of your points there. So Kevin Durant, first of all, is shooting over 40% on pull-up threes this year.
Can I tell you that I knew it was going to be higher, but I didn't want to. I would rather sound like an idiot that way than the other way.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's how I'd play it as well. And then you can look at Kyrie Irving, who's also, you know, in the mix with some of the best pull-up artists in basketball. He's shooting 43.5% on pull-up threes. So even without...
That's outrageous. That's outrageous.
I know. And you know what it lets him do is
so stupid.
You can play Drummond and Bruce Brown at the same time and not worry as much about spacing because, you know, I think our general concepts of spacing are horizontal, right? Like you want the defense spread out width-wise to create space in the paint. Well, spreading a defense out vertically is helpful too. And if you've got to guard two guys up to 30 feet because they can pull up from anywhere, that's really tough. And this is going to be an awesome test for Boston's defense because
it is.
Guess what Kevin Durant's shooting percentiles are? At the rim, 85th percentile. Mid-range, 92nd percentile. Threes, 82nd percentile. Pull-up threes, close to 100th percentile. There is nowhere that Kevin Durant can't get his shot off and can't get it off very, very efficiently. So it's going to be a tough series. The lines opened all over the place. Like, you could have got – I missed the window on it because I was watching the Wolves game and I wasn't quick enough. But there was a time where you could have middled the series where you win no matter what because some books had Boston as a favorite, some books had Brooklyn as a favorite. It's settled in now at Boston -135, Brooklyn +115. So Boston has moved back to the favorite side. I don't know if that's people value hunting when Boston was an underdog or Boston being one of the league's most public teams. But even still, those lines suggest like a 47-53 series percentage-wise. And for a 2-7 matchup, that you got to feel bad if you're Boston. Especially like you're not getting Robert Williams back this series from the sounds of it.
Yep.
And he was pivotal for your defense being as good as it was.
So those are some really great thoughts. And if I'm Boston, we've just played the, you know, best defense in basketball this year. We came off this terrific season where Tatum really entered a different stratosphere of player. Marcus Smart found himself as a point guard. Time Lord found himself as one of the better rim protectors in the league. You do probably feel a little snake bit by this matchup this early, especially considering no one's going to cry for Boston in this market ever, but it's not fun having to face Kyrie Irving, a guy that left town pretty acrimoniously with the prospect of him coming in and beating your team. Like, if you saw Patrick Beverley last night, the way he celebrated against the Clippers, I don't think Kyrie is going to ever celebrate that way, but he will be internally, and you better believe that Celtics fans will know exactly where they were when Kyrie snatched a series from them in a season where the league is pretty wide open and they have machinations of a championship. I just think two things off of what you said. One is that the Andre Drummond question, I actually do see a place for him in this series just because the way he operated in the pick and roll yesterday with Kyrie and with Kevin Durant, it just looked like something that you can get a few minutes off the bench with, right? And if he's just halfway competent with his free throws, I don't know. I just think he can draw some Celtics into some foul trouble. And without Robert Williams in this series, I kind of think, well, will he be able to bully an Al Horford? Will he be able to get to some of those spots? I really do think that he could be a piece. Not a pivotal piece, or maybe not the most important piece, but I actually liked what he was doing in that game, and I went, you know, that was nice that they just ended up with getting him in a throw-in because he does know how to do that one thing pretty well. You mentioned
and
the Seth
Curry thing.
And he can
pass a little bit, which is going to be really important as far as spacing goes, right? Like, you get that high screen and roll, and he's in those four-on-three situations at the free-throw line. Mm-hmm. You know, that's he can make those passes at least at a capable level.
Plus, he's in prove-it mode with his career, I think, a little bit, where this is a guy that people have always said doesn't care about basketball, and they've always sort of questioned his motivations. Well, now he's playing with two of the best players on the planet, and there's a role for him. So I am curious to see how that operates. I think Curry is still getting acclimated from the injury and that he looked a little rusty in that game. They didn't get what you expect from him, but I'm not putting a lot of stock into the Ben Simmons thing for now. I need to see it before I believe it. He's just... he hasn't played basketball the entire year, and the last time we saw him was the worst playoff performance by a star since Paulie DeRozan. so anyways, let's see it from Ben Simmons. The other thought I had off this game, though, and I'm going to make it Raptors-related before we talk about Kawhi. Well, it's going to be two Raptors-related questions here in a row. Did watching that game and the reminder of, oh, right, playoff basketball really does come down to stars and the ability of stars to elevate their games and play added minutes make you feel any differently about us heading into this series against the Sixers? Because I think for a lot of people it may have.
Well, Grange said yesterday that the Raptors have more stars, like more depth in terms of having better guys. Yes, there's Joel Embiid, so, you know, he's got the big name, but I feel better about the Raptors having a couple people that are stars. And we saw that last night with, you know, if you have two or three guys that are, can put the team on their back, I feel more confident about the Raptors. You're right. Playoff basketball is who shows up and who can be an all-star. The rest of the season matters, but we've been talking about, okay, the Raptors are in, like, what do they have to play for right now? Well, they have their stars to show up. So maybe it did change my perspective a bit in terms of Raptors have a lot of depth, a lot of players that are peaking at the right time. That makes me feel much more confident in the matchup. And that's kind of what Grange laid out for us as well. When you look at how these two teams match up, is the Raptors have lots of good players and a couple great players.
Ailish, that sounds like someone who is very confident in Pascal Siakam carrying over his great regular season to a playoff series.
I certainly do think he's matured. And we talked about that all season long about how, hey, yes, it's how you show up in the playoffs, but he has proven all season long that he's got the consistency. He's matured. He seems like he really believes in himself. He's playing with more joy. And those things I weigh heavily when I look at him having a completely different postseason. So, yeah, I feel confident. I'm also hoping that he does those things because he deserves to have the accolades that he can be a well-rounded player when it matters.
Nothing changed too much for me, mostly because I was already entering the 76ers series with a healthy amount of respect and reverence and fear of Joel Embiid. And if you're looking at top scorers who can take over games like KD and Kyrie did, James Harden's the one guy at the top of that pile that's never really shown it at the same level in the playoffs, at least not efficiently. Volume-wise, sure. So that's... You know, I'd be in as much prove-it mode with James Harden as some Raptors fans still are with Pascal Siakam. So Joel Embiid's going to be the best player in the series. But you're right, Ailish. This is a series that is going to be – I mean, it's going to be fought with the acknowledgement that Embiid's the best player in the series. And then it's about, can you have the second best player? Mm-hmm. Can your number three guy be better? Can your number four guy be better? But the
I think it's interesting that you guys took it this way.
Joel Embiid. It's just he's not it's not the same. I don't know. I wonder if maybe it's just like aesthetically it's easier to believe in a perimeter guy like KD or Kyrie being able to command a game like that, even though obviously Embiid can put up 40 when he wants. I think it's mostly JD for me. It's not necessarily a Raptors optimism so much as a hardened skepticism.
Which is completely reasonable and the way to look at it. But to me, I do believe this, and I'm with you guys in the sense of I think that Siakam is right now unquestionably a better basketball player than James Harden.
Certainly had a better season.
Yeah, he had a better season, but also, like you said, if he had done this in the playoffs where James Harden had this incredible track record of success and this, oh, well, he's turned the switch and blah, 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 then it would be different, right? Because we'd be going, oh, Pascal has improved it. But it's actually weird because both of them are very similar in terms of, well, no, they've both stumbled in the postseason before. Harden obviously is a much better scorer or has been historically throughout his career. But yes, Siakam has expanded his scoring profile this season and the way that he gets others involved. Like even in Grange's piece, the biggest thing from it was, right, the Celtics players saying, hey, we just need to force him right and then we can take everything away from him. And that's not the player anymore, right? That's not the guy anymore.
There's also a big thing in Grange's piece, and it's been the story of the season for Siakam, is that growth has also come on the defensive end, where he's become their best rim protector, he's gotten back to being a high motor guy on that end of the floor, because JD, to a point you've made for months now, he's the best conditioned guy in the NBA, perhaps.
That's an area too, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, like if the scoring does struggle a little bit, he has more paths to impacting the game because he's an elite defender.
Okay, so it sounds like both of you just actually feel more emboldened by the Raptors, which is interesting because I think that...
I was neutral, I think.
Okay. I just looked at it as, hey, you know, we had a game where I like Darius Garland, and he just came off of a great year, and I actually think one of the biggest screw-ups in the game was early on. They sat him for an inexplicable amount of time. I was like, do you think that he's 36 years old and that you got arrested? Like, the game is slipping away and you have your only good player on the bench for like 5 minutes. It was I actually wondered if they thought he was on the floor. Like, did he get hurt? I'm going, what the hell is happening in this game? This is a do or die all or nothing. You push the chips into the middle. It's just that it was a bit of a reminder for me with all the takes that we've had about Brooklyn, right? Where it's, hey, what's up with the defense? What's up with the depth? That's a question that we ask about Philadelphia too, right? What's up with the depth? What's up with the depth? And it's kind of like playoff hockey where there's a little bit more of an edge and there's whistles that go away and you remember that toughness matters in the playoffs and that it's a different sport come playoff time. And it was yet again another bit of an eye-opener, and I'm not saying that Joel Embiid and James Harden or Kyrie and KD from a scoring standpoint, but those two guys together profile closer than Fred VanVleet and Pascal Siakam do as the two best players in this series. So I'm just looking at it and saying those two guys and sleeping on the idea that they couldn't show up for a series and just kind of end up making this a bit of a splash of cold water, there's a chance of this, okay? So to me it was. I would say I wasn't neutral. Maybe we all went in different directions. Ailish more emboldened, thinking that the Raptors have the better stars. I would disagree, but I think that it's closer to that than people would be projecting it to, because I have Siakam over Harden at this point in their careers. I'm not neutral like Blake. I just sort of did look at it and go, boy, Joel Embiid just had an MVP season. And as much as we're all kind of like celebrating this Raptors team right now and believing that they can go out there and win, I think that Embiid being the best player in the series is more important than Matisse Thybulle missing potentially a couple of the games. And that has dominated the coverage of this series more early on in the week.
Yeah, mine's just a hubris move of patting myself. You know what? My analysis was good already. I don't need to change my opinion too much.
You did put in the most amount of work by like a significant margin, so that does make sense. Okay, last thing before we go to break. Kawhi Leonard, his team loses. There was a little bit of buzz about, hey, is Kawhi going to return if the Clippers can get through this game? Early on, I'm thinking, Blake, why did we bet on Minnesota when Ty Lue is the coach and he's just – this guy – like, poor Karl Anthony Towns almost had his career defined last night by Ty Lue's ability to just eviscerate big men in the postseason. They lose, though. And now we're entering a year where Kawhi comes back and he's 31, and Paul George comes back and he's 31, and neither guy has been particularly healthy for long periods of time. It's a team that doesn't have a lot of asset capital, draft pick capital, players that, if you're looking at the team around the margins, areas of internal growth and improvement, there don't seem to be too many. You can be creative in the NBA, and this front office has proven to be that. And so I'm going to guess that they will have a trick or two up their sleeve that we don't see as of right now. But is next year the quote-unquote all-in season for Kawhi Leonard and Paul George in terms of the way that we evaluate the Clippers maneuvering and all of the trading of the draft picks, plus Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, a known commodity, for Paul George to build around Kawhi?
I think it's a huge one for them, for sure. And it's not because George and Kawhi are foot out the door. Both of them have player options in 2024 we're looking at. But like you said, they're both coming back from injury. They're both going to be in their early 30s. And how many times you can come back from injury capably is a real question mark for that. The other thing I would say is I actually think that this stretch of time without Kawhi and Paul George, obviously nothing's ever going to be silver lining enough to losing a year of Kawhi Leonard in his prime. However, Norman Powell and Robert Covington look like good fits. You figured out how to use Reggie Jackson. Not having two stars, I think, has given Ty Lue the bandwidth to really show what he can do as a coach at both ends of the floor. And if you add a healthy Paul George and 60 games of Kawhi Leonard to this thing next year, and their only key free agent is Robert Covington, who I'd imagine wants to stay and they have bird rights on, this team could make a pretty quick turnaround if Kawhi's even relatively Kawhi-ish, because yeah, Norman Covington are fits. Reggie Jackson looks good. And Terrence Mann looks like a player. And we know that to make this stuff work with two guys making $43 million, you need to find a cheap guy like Terrence Mann making $2 million who can fit into your rotation. You still have Batum fairly cheap if he picks up that option. I like where the Clippers are at for a quick turnaround, assuming Kawhi is healthy. But yeah, if I'm the Clippers, I'm like, okay, well, I got to maximize 2022, 2023, because if Kawhi is healthy, if Paul George is healthy, well, you don't know how many years left you have of that. And you don't know what 33, 34-year-old Kawhi looks like, given what his lower half has gone through in terms of injuries.
I will say the last time we saw Kawhi, he was as dominant as we'd probably ever seen him. You know, he's a first team All-NBA last season. He was better in the playoffs, unfortunate injury. So I feel more confident that he wasn't on the decline, obviously. He was playing some of his best basketball. So if he can return to that version, completely different story. You know, they could be one of the most talented teams in the West. But yeah, there's so many questions. How are we supposed to evaluate this, not knowing the extent of where he's at? But I do have that little bit of confidence in my back pocket that he has that competitive drive to get back and be where he was before the injury. And that's why I feel like you're right with next season being this all-in year. If he's back to healthy, like, you get a real good perspective of what this team is finally.
But the question isn't like, will the Clippers be dangerous? The question is like this all in? And I think, Blake, actually what you outlined is that it is that they have all these, that they have all these pieces, and the way that these guys are going right now, that's not a lot of runway for all these things around. And Ailish, even you do, where you're like, the last time we saw him, he was looking great. He performed extremely well, but yes, then he got hurt. That he missed an entire season. And so, like, that's the thing for me is I feel like the Clippers are dangerous next year. There's a reasonable case to be made that the two of you just did, which is that they're the favorites in the Western Conference next year. Like, that they show up and they're the favorites in the Western Conference next year. And I think that that's an intense thing for that to be on their shoulders, knowing that if they don't get that done, you could end up seeing some pretty significant moves. And I really do think that that's the nail in the coffin of, did Kawhi make the mistake? Well, yes, because this will be one of the last years of, I think, his prime that you can count on.
And it's one thing to find a role for Reggie Jackson and hit on the Nick Batum bounce back and hit on a deep pick like Terrence Mann. It's another to keep doing those things, because you're not gonna, like, you have the taxpayer mid-level to use, and you have the minimum, and guys will want to play there because it's LA and it's you know, it's a good team, and it's, I think Ty Lue is incredibly well respected around the league by players. So yeah, but you've got to continue to hit on that as a front office, because look at the Western Conference. The margins are very, very slim to where Steph Curry has a questionable status, and we're like, ooh, the Warriors against the Nuggets? Like, is Jokic going to take that thing? Or on the other hand, Jokic wins maybe his second straight MVP and is bouncing the first round again. Both conferences, really, the way we've teed this up, are very, very good. It's going to be a really, really fun year for the playoffs. Tonight's the one night where the matchups aren't entirely spicy, with the 9-10 matchups of Charlotte-Atlanta, San Antonio-New Orleans. Maybe we'll touch on those in the wake and rake. We'll see if either make our picks.